This is a group interview with five members of the 1968 Stonington bass team, recorded by Chris Alden Lee at the Marguerite Bay reunion at Bowness on Windermere on the 6th of November 2009. The interviewees are, from left to right, Phil Wainwright, Ian Sykes, Ian Smith, Ken Doyle, and Edward Madders. The Stonington bass team of 1968.
Phil Wainwright, place of birth, Stoke-on-Trent, 14th of June 1945.
Weatherby, Yorkshire, Ian Sykes, 10th of January 1943.
Told you so. Ian Smith, West Bridgeford, Nottingham, 29th of June 1944.
Oh. Ken Doyle, 10th of September 1932, born at High Lake on the Wirral.
Edward Cresswell Madders, from Altrincham, born 19th of May 1941, 08, 40 hours.
But you're known as Chris, is that correct?
Yes, I'm known as Chris, yes.
And you were all at Stonington in the winter of 68?
We were.
We were,
yeah. Why?
Why? Me? Yes. Because... I went down as a surveyor, having been interested for years and years, and guided that way from university, and also guided that way because I knew Malcolm Phelps, who was first mate on the Biscoe, and he wanted me actually to go down as an AB, and I eventually went down as a FID, which bitterly disappointed him.
But, what's an AB?
An able seaman on the Biscoe. So that was why I was there.
What's your first knowledge of the Antarctic? When did you become aware the Antarctic existed, Phil?
I guess it was school time, and then it built up university with meeting people who'd been down, because one of my tutors was... he'd been a FID at Signy in the early days, and that sort of fed the fever, if you like.
Who was that?
Derek Mayling, and he was down there 1948.
Ian, what's your first knowledge of the Antarctic?
Well, I actually was in the RAF some time before I went down, and I got shortlisted to go on an expedition to South Georgia. I didn't actually go at the last minute, I didn't get the chance. And then I finished up as a climbing instructor and sort of out of bound schools and things. And I was quite pally with Johnny Cunningham, who suggested that I would like it. And I applied, not really thinking that I'd get it, but I went down as a GA to Stonners.
Was it an easy interview?
Well, it seemed it at the time, yeah. I thought I was expecting much more of a grilling. And I was actually surprised, you know, that it... I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was... what's his name?
Bill Sloman.
Bill Sloman and a couple of other who I actually found that I liked immensely. And he was very friendly. And I was surprised also afterwards that I discovered that the people I'd put down as referees, they'd actually phoned them up and spoken to them afterwards, which was, in those days, pretty unusual. So I realised that... I'd actually taken it more seriously than I thought. When I heard that, I thought, I've got a chance, you know, I'm going. And also in those days, of course, money wasn't a target. We were, in fact, I think it was £500 a year. But I would have gone if I'd had to pay, I think.
How about Ian Smith? What's your first... When did you become aware that the Antarctic existed?
Well... What I can first remember was I went on holiday to Charmouth when I was 10 and found ammonites and became interested in geology. And then in 1957, there was the International Geophysical Year. And I didn't quite understand the connection between that and geology, but I realised that, wow, they do science, which I was going to do. I had to do science and it was going to be geology. And gradually the two things came together. And so since 1957, I thought I can do... what I want to do, and I can go to the Antarctic. And I mean, I didn't have any of the experience and knowledge of climbing that Ian did, but I became interested in outdoor pursuits and rock climbing was the other passion, and you know, you sort of get these things, and there's only one thing to do, wasn't there? That's what we had to do.
And did you see an advert somewhere? I mean, how did you get to apply?
Well, I knew a chap called Peter Kennett, who was a geophysicist a couple of years before me. I'd met him socially, had lived in the same place. And I really can't remember exactly what I saw that I responded to. But I remember the interview. But I was rather privileged. I actually joined a year earlier, and I was paid £997 to go to Birmingham University to do an MSc, because they didn't have any geophysicists. So I did my degree and was interviewed to spend a year in Birmingham University. And I was interviewed by the late lamented Don Griffiths, who was the professor of geophysics, who did many years Antarctic marine survey, and Bill Sloman. And again, it was a fantastic interview. I remember thinking, these are really good people.
Ken Boyle.
Yeah.
What was your first inkling that the Antarctic actually was a real place?
I think it was going back to sort of reading travel books as a kid. I read Scott of the Antarctic, things like that. I can remember seeing the film when that came out.
John Mills.
Yes.
John Mills film.
But of course, it was just a distant place that I never really ever expected to get the chance to go to.
So how did the opportunity arise?
I was in the mining industry, and in 1965 there were some jetties going to be built at two of the bases, and there was an advert in the Colliery Guardian, which I used to get, saying they wanted somebody to use explosives in the Antarctic, and it was going to be a seven-month contract. So I thought, sounds interesting, I'll apply, I won't stand any chance. Like everybody else, I had an interview in London, which was very, very informal, I think everybody agrees. Bill Sloman and, I forgot the other man, the one that was in charge of supplies. No.
It was Maurice Sumner that was with mine.
No, it wasn't Maurice, it was another one.
Ted Clapp.
No, he moved off to another branch of the civil service eventually. Forgotten his name, and he was very sort of very informal. And I always remember at the end of the day, this somebody said, "You've never asked what the wage is," and I said, "No, I didn't." And they pushed me out to for a medical, and said, "We'll let you know." And within a couple of days, I found out I got this post, which was only really for a summer building job. When I got joined the ship eventually in October, I think it was, John Biscoe, there was a delay because of engine trouble, and one lad had gone home and decided to change his mind. So we set off without him, and on the way I thought, I wonder if there's any chance of staying on beyond that summer building job. And eventually they said yes, so I was able to go to Stonington for the winter of 66, and then I'd enjoyed it so much. When I went home, I think I'd been home 3 days when I wrote off to the survey to see if I could go back, which is why I was back in 68, same time as these lads.
Okay, thank you. Chris Mathers, what was your first knowledge of the Antarctic?
No, probably reading Scott's book, actually, when I was a youngster. Unfortunately, I had some advantage over a lot of people, because I'd already been travelling a lot before I actually went to the Antarctic. I've been in the Merchant Navy as a radio officer and travelled quite extensively for 3.5 years. And anyway, I decided that I thought I might be missing something ashore, so I thought I'd go and work ashore for 2 years. I studied working in a steelworks as an electronic mechanic in Sheffield. And I saw this advertisement in a radio, it was Shortwave magazine actually, that they required radio operators in the Antarctic. So I thought, well, why not? You know, I might just as well. I was interested in the place. I wanted to travel again, which I might point out I'm still doing now. And I'm nearly 69 and I'm here, there and everywhere. So I went down for the interview And like the other gentlemen say, it was a fairly informal thing, Bill Sloman. And I didn't think I'd ever get the job, but I did, and off I went. And I will say one thing, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I learnt a lot. And it has really opened my eyes, you know, coupled with all the other travelling I've done. It has extended my knowledge considerably regarding people and everything. And that's the reason why I went down, and I think I'm being rewarded by the experiences of the Antarctic, and also coupled with all my other travelling experiences. I went back to sea again after I'd left the Antarctic. And as I say, I'm still travelling now. And as I get older, I become more interested in history and everything associated with it.
Just going back to this informal interview, did any of you ever suspect that you were being psychologically grilled at that interview to see how you cope with being in the Antarctic?
Not at the time, but later on I went back to for another winter, and I was involved in some of the interviews, and it was only then that I realised actually how clever they were. And although they seemed like a nice, friendly, informal chat, that there were very pertinent questions lobbed in at specific times, and there were people noting down the responses to those. So I only realised later is
that's interesting. My feeling was that they weren't asking particularly focused questions on psychology, and we'd heard that the US Antarctic Research Program people were being given psychological tests this sort of thing. I thought, well, we were just asked, you know, why do you want to go to the Antarctic? So it's quite interesting, the different focuses.
I think the same, other than the fact I was had this rather surprise that I remember it was a bank manager that one of my people that asked to act as referee, who I knew very well, and he told me that they'd been on the phone for about an hour talking to him.
Oh, really?
And I was absolutely flabbergasted, you know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, the sense out, well, as far as I was concerned, that, you know, the referees I gave, they got forms to fill in.
Yeah.
How many times a day, a week, does he change his socks, and does he smell and all sorts of things like that. And these were the responses I got from the referees that I had given. Going back to the interview, as far as I was concerned, they never asked to see my qualifications even. I mean, I did have qualifications because I'd been to sea as a radio operator officer, but they never asked to see them. They just assumed that what I'd put down on the form I'd actually got. I mean, I could have been anybody. And I think as far as there was one thing I thought that was rather odd. As the interview came, it was getting pretty late by the time I finished the interview, and they had to go for a medical, and I was given instructions how to get to the hospital. I can't remember where it was now. All verbally, you had to get this bus, get that bus. So what I did, I went outside and got a taxi.
Very true.
Yeah,
when you got there, what was the mix right? Did all the men in your year, the season, are we talking about 68/69 that you were there?
67/68. We all, I think, went down on the same ship apart from Phil.
Right.
Didn't we? We all met on the Shackleton.
Yeah, I got off early because I was shipped in early.
Some of us went on to the Perla Down and went down to the Weddell Sea to Halley Bay.
So when you got there, were they right? Had they picked a team?
There was one person who stood out.
In what way?
Ken Portwine.
Exactly.
He was a youth hostel warden from Coniston. In fact, a very nice guy, but he was different. Mm. And in fact, he turned out he was very ill, and
he's on my list of questions. So, in what way was Ken different?
He would retreat. I think it was depression, really. Mm. It was that sort. I don't know whether we quite knew what that meant, but you wouldn't see him for several days, or he'd be very reclusive. And I gather that's one of the symptoms of, you know, after the event, that's one of the symptoms of ulcerative colitis, which was the problem.
Yeah.
I was quite friendly with him on the boat. I liked him. And he
was a great character.
He knew people that I knew, which was a thing. So, but he was definitely behaving rather oddly, even on the boat going down.
Mm.
And I think we all understood that the captains of the ships, you know, in our case, Frosty, had an awful lot of power in the survey. So that if they had realised there was anything wrong, I think they did actually fish odd people out.
We were able to, because I went down the second time as King Fid, which was sort of, because I'd been before in charge of the others, and I was supposed to talk to the captain and say, well, he would say, what about such and such? What do you find, how do you find him? Yeah. Oh, you know, I'm not very good at picking people out like that, but I did what I could to say that how I felt that they were.
Mm.
But there was only one.
Bugs McKeith was another one that was
He got off the ship, didn't he?
And he got.
This possibility of being sent back from, if they weren't fitting in, being sent back from
Stanley.
From Stanley. Now, the only. Who else remembers?
You're not talking
I'll not mention any names, but that particular time, there was one lad that was on the point, I gather, of being sent back from Port Stanley. It was just the way he was that, I'm not going to mention his name at all. Without realising it, he got people's backs up. It was just his way of speaking, his way of asking questions, and making silly statements. And eventually they thought about it, and I believe the ingoing base commander at Halley Bay said, no, send him. Halley Bay's a big enough, was it 40 people that were there? Something like that. They're big enough to swallow him up, we'll sort him out. But that's the only time I've ever heard of anyone being on the point of being sent home.
So the selection process continued on the ship?
It continued on the ship,
interesting.
And you have to remember that we left Southampton in September 67, and we didn't reach Stonington until March 68. So we'd been everywhere. We'd been to all the bases. We'd worked cargo. We'd seen volcanoes explode and all manner of things. And all that time, we'd been monitored by everybody, by the captains, by people in Stanley. And by the end, we'd all been.
I missed out on that, Phil, because if you remember, in my case, the previous year, the diesel mechanic and radio operator had been killed at Stonington Island. So what happened with me was, being as I wanted a radio operator at Stonington Island, and I was going down as a radio operator, they wanted me down there. And I often wonder whether this was part of the process of assessing you. So I was, the ship went to Cygnia Island, it did the relief of the Cygnia Island base, and all these other gentlemen here, they went to South Georgia, Halley Bay, and here, there, and everywhere. But in December, it'd be about, this was 1966 I'm talking about now. I know you want to talk about 68, basically, but
that's right.
So I was taken to Palmer Station on Anvers Island. I was on the Bisco, and actually I was informed in the bar that I was being, you know, sort of disembarked at Anvers Island, at Palmer Station. There was myself and Rod Leddingham. There were two of us. We were flown to the top end, to the northern end of Adelaide Island. I forget who actually met us now. I think, I can't remember the names. And we were taken by a muskeg sledge down to Adelaide Island Base, which is about 90 miles down there. And then I was flown then from Adelaide Island on this was the following day, to Stonington Island. And the aircraft landed on the North East Glacier. I always remember that I was met by Dave Matthews, another team, so I was dumped in at the deep end. So I basically arrived I was taken off a nice warm bar on a ship, dumped on a nice pediment on Adelaide Island, and arrived at Stonington Island, and wow. As I say, by Dave Matthews. And from there on, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I know John Noble, who unfortunately is not with us anymore, he took me out the day after I'd arrived. I was absolutely, well, I'll say it, knackered, because it was quite a large transformation for me. And he took me around out towards Nenny Island on his sledge, like, and then I just sort of settled into life at Stonington Island. So I was down here, down at Stonington Island, probably 2 months before the rest of them arrived down. So when they all came down, I felt as though I'd been there for years.
Let's just go back to the story of Ken Portwine then. How did he obviously slip through the net on the way down? How did the story evolve from there? How did it unfold?
He went to Argentine Islands. Yeah. That's where he went. He was the cook, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And as I understand, the gossip that... Well, we know a little bit about it because Mike Holmes was the doctor who was wintering with us, and there was radio communication between Argentine Islands as things evolved. But I understand the problem first materialised when they were running out of toilet paper.
Yes.
Do you remember that? Yeah.
That was the first
and so they kept watch on the toilet to see who was... Yeah. Yeah. Nipping in, and it was poor Ken. He, you know, I think you squitter blood and have a pretty rough time. But he wasn't talking to anyone, and he was, you know, in his shell. And I think the base leader, who I can't remember, accosted him. And
Was it Dudney? Yes, of course it was. John Dudney, base commander at Argentina.
And then I think got onto Mike, and I mean, I don't think Mike said anything that he shouldn't have said to us, but you know, we knew there was a drama.
A lot of it was conducted, I mean, I'll say this, I might as well admit, it's all happened in the past. Some of it was conducted in coded messages, and there was a lot of very technical medical jargon used. I set up some skeds with Argentine Islands where we used reverse sideband so that sledge parties couldn't hear what was being, you know, discussed. And it's all in the logbooks here anyway, because I recorded it all in the logbooks, but there was a lot of talk went on. And in some instances, I know that Alistair MacArthur, I set him up radio links with Argentine Islands, and even I didn't listen into what was said, so...
Is Alistair MacArthur?
He was the base commander at the time.
That's Stonington.
So poor old Ken was at Argentine, but you were trying to deal with it remotely. Yes.
That's right.
They didn't have a doctor.
There was another interesting thing that is going on, it's all in the past, but... They had these, you know, we used to have what the ships call the goon show, and at night we used to radio in. And there were the days, in the very early days when we were on voice, I think prior to us, everybody was all keys.
But we had
these terrific, in those days were fantastic radios, these squad calls.
Squad calls.
So we could hear, but you could also hear the tuning signal of other people tuning in.
Yeah.
And it was there's a sort of funny side to it, was that we'd have the evening, we'd tell everybody where we were and what was going on, with the usual chit-chat. And then Mike Holmes or somebody would come onto the air and say, we've got a private sked with the Argentine Islands over the Ken Buchmann, and would everybody go off the air? And you could hear all the tuning signals coming up as all the different sledges were tuning in to listen, you know. And then after it was all over, you know, because there was all sorts of things, poor Ken was, you know, thinking that they were trying to kill him, and there were lots of really nasty, they all hate me, and this sort of thing, you know. And then the sked would finish, and a few minutes had passed, and then a voice would come onto the air and said, did you hear that, you know? Yeah, and we were all, it was a kind of macabre thing, but it was a long way from us in some ways, wasn't it,
you know? Yes, I don't think... I was getting confused with the protector which came down. That was the next year, wasn't it, for another incident. But he was... They took an icebreaker out of dry dock in BA,
yeah,
was it?
Yes.
And came down to the ice edge. Yeah. And
but they flew...
it was a General San Martín.
There was another one with a flight from...
It was an
Argentinian, yes.
And they landed on Galinda.
It was a beaver.
They were going to fly him out. And they loaded Kit Ken and...
This is in the middle of the winter.
Yes. Mm. And the plane crashed on takeoff.
It hit an iceberg on takeoff.
It was one of these, but nobody was injured. And so this saga just kept going on and on.
What happened after that? Was there? Well,
the doctor was. They then got an Argentinian doctor on the base, and he
was it from Esperanza?
And he looked up. And in the meantime, the Endurance got within helicopter range,
and finally, was
finally lifted him and the Argentinian doctor off, and. The Bass really wanted to fly Ken back home to UK to be operated on, but the Argies insisted on him going to Buenos Aires. And
was it Endurance?
Was it Argentinian?
No, it was Endurance. It was Argentine.
Are you sure?
I've been under the impression it's Endurance.
I wonder whether we're getting mixed up with the
General
next year.
General San Martin.
Could be.
Anyway. He was helicoptered off.
It was
General San Martin.
There was a fair bit of stramash about it. But anyway, ultimately, it went to Buenos Aires and they operated on him and he died. You know.
Well, second operation, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was tragic, you know.
When something like that happens, what does it do to base morale? I mean, he wasn't on your base, but you were...
Well, for us, I don't think it affected as much, did it?
No, it was probably true.
I think they split up Argentina. I think there was a lot of trouble on Argentine Island.
Was there?
And the split. But the Dalites of Barry Whitaker and whatnot, were they not at Argentina?
I've heard about all this.
I can't remember where Barry was.
I'm pretty sure that they split them up because there was a fair degree of unhappiness.
Yeah.
And a few went to Adelaide. I don't think we got anybody at
Because they'd had all the extra work. I mean, they were scientists trying to do their job, and they got to knock off to actors and nurses.
That's right,
cooks and all this sort of thing. You know, which probably put a certain amount of pressure on them.
I think the nursing care was intense, and that used up two or more people full time.
And because he didn't declare his illness before he went south.
He probably didn't know about it, though.
Probably didn't.
Possibly didn't.
But it's interesting, the critical thing, I think he was the cook, and so obviously, you know, everything was, he was just there to produce the food, but because he was taken out, it made a real difference, whereas if it had been a Met man, it probably wouldn't have had such an impact on the base.
I don't want to spend the whole interview talking about tragedies, but whilst we are on that subject, you came in on the tail end of the loss of Tom Allen and John Knoll, didn't you?
Yes.
What was your connection with that event?
They'd both gone out. The Bass always accepted the fact that they were people with an outdoor background, outdoor interests, and if they could run a holiday trip, let them. I think that was Bass's attitude, wasn't it, really? They went out on a trip, borrowed somebody else's dog sledges, got into bad weather, and we realised after a bit they hadn't reported in for a long time, I think it was going on for 2 weeks. That was against the rules. If you hadn't been able to contact base in 4 days, you were supposed to turn around and go back.
I used to do it every day.
But nobody worried particularly because there'd been bad weather. They were both experienced. I mean, Tom Allen had been up in Norway. He was a real outdoor lad, and the other lad, John Knoll, had done a lot of climbing. Snow and ice work. Eventually they thought this had gone on too long, and two of them went out to follow. They knew where they'd called in from last, and who was it? Marsden, Neil Marsden and Keith Holmes went out and found the... went over the top of a bit of a pass over the glacier. There was the dog's team were buried. Tom Allen was sort of lying half covered in the snow at the side of the valley. John Knoll was his shoulder and his head was up out of a snow hole, looking as if towards Tom Allen. And so the two that found them straight away, this was getting towards the winter, you were down to about, what, 4 or 5 hours daylight? Well, not really daylight, sort of half light. They came, rather than go onto the radio and say anything, which apparently Port Stanley people have a lot of shortwave radios and they listen, as a hobby, they listen in to the sledge, anything they can, they can get, they listen to.
And the record programmes that so I used to transmit.
So Keith and what's your name?
Neil.
Decided to head back for base. They did this quick rundown and finished up in practically in darkness coming down the northeast glacier to tell what had happened. Now then it was in the hands of base commander Terry Tallis, who was sending messages, coded messages, off to London. And they decided that there'd be an attempt to bring the bodies back to base. This was done by Keith Holmes, Neil Marsden, Ian Ross and myself. I know personally, I knew this was coming and I was regretting it for days beforehand. Ian Ross had been the year before at Halley Bay. Mm. There'd been two men went down in a skidoo. And Ian Ross was following them behind with a dog sledge. Was it two or three? Was the doctor? Anyway, they were just killed.
He was left alone.
He was left alone with the dog team, who'd been so used to following behind this skidoo and having a nice, easy time of it. I gather they had a real problem to get them to work and take them back to base. They changed him over to our base, didn't they? To Stannington, but. He was, although I shared a tent with him on that particular trip, he never spoke much about it. But I mean, it must have had a heck of an effect on him. The four of us set off with, we took four teams, enough for four teams and three sledges, because we knew there was a sledge out there which we were hoping could bring back. Then it was a case of just putting the bodies on sledge and bringing them back to base and putting them in a big sort of stone cairn, didn't we? Stone cairn, and eventually it was concreted over when the following summer. But it just flattened the feeling of midsummer was coming up, which is usually it's sort of holiday, isn't it? Yeah, it's a holiday, midsummer day. You always get dressed up and have a meal. It just flattened it.
They were Stonington men, were they? They were Stonington men, these two.
Could I just say something here? As I say, I was shipped in a dump you in sort of thing. And I got to Stonington Island, and I'd had heard about this story, actually. But I didn't know much about it. And there was a release in the press in this country about what had happened, but it wasn't the truth that went into the press release. And
what would the press release say?
The press release said that they'd been hit by flying rocks or something, and the story is that, yes, there was a press release about it, because somebody mentioned it to me before I went down. Yeah. And it wasn't mentioned to me until I got to Port Stanley, basically. And the full story about, I didn't even know the full story until I met Ken, and obviously we knew about it then. But I did find that when I got onto base, I was made very welcome. But there seemed to be a rather strange atmosphere on base. And I obviously, as I've got older, I appreciate now why this was done. You know, I was sort of welcomed with open arms. And I'll say one thing now, and I'll say it now here. Dave Matthews, he was very good to me. And I really respect him for coming up to meet me, take me down. And John Noble and the people that were there on base, even Terry Tallis, we used to have a bit of fun. He even brought me a cup of tea up the first morning I was there. And I'm sure he never did that with anybody else. but I will say that, I will say one thing. I really appreciate how, because I was really dumped in at the deep end.
Well, you were replacing one of the...
Yes, I know. But at the time, I didn't appreciate it. But as years have gone by, and I want this to be recorded, I have started to appreciate it. And that's that's it. Then.
Let's move on to the happier. What was Stonington like in its 68? What kind of, if I Paint me a little picture of what it was like.
Well, I think we had a very good year, what they call a good year. Mm. And I think that was it's a fixed term almost. Because we had no accidents of any kind. In fact, in the 2.5 years that I was there, most of us got on extremely well. You know, it was one of those. It's the thing about Stonington is it's in such a beautiful place.
Wonderful, you know,
it's the most wonderful site.
What stays the memory all these years later?
I think for me, it's a tiny island. You know, it's only 400 yards by 200 yards, something like that. But it's surrounded by mountains. There's actually Nenni Island in front of it, an island, but it's a mountain sticking out of the sea. And there's Roman Fort, it's an absolutely startling thing. And this beautiful bay in front with this massive glacier, about 10 miles wide, the North East Glacier, coming down, pouring onto the island. And
so it wasn't really an island, was it?
It wasn't a true island.
It is now.
But it's in those island. Days, there was the ramp that ran onto it. Mm. And it was, well, to me, I still think of it as the most beautiful place I've ever been, you know. And
what a privilege.
It was a real privilege. Yeah. There were, how many of us? 60 or 70. There must have been 150 dogs or something like that, 70 pups at any one time there, you know. So the whole island was just covered, in summer it was covered in blubber. And
when ships came in, new people or visitors would come ashore and they'd say, "What's that dreadful smell?" Well, but it was the whole island.
Yeah, I can remember smelling.
Was that us that smelled?
Yes. the whole island just reached a rancid seal and dog.
From feeding dogs.
Yeah.
Even in our water was full of dog shit.
And it was when you emptied the tanks and hair, you know. Turds lying at the bottom.
I remember once, to melt water, we used to cut blocks of
snow. You used to drink that, aren't you?
And we'd cut blocks of snow from the drifts, and how it happened exactly, I do not know. But somebody, one of us, cut a block, and it went into the big copper meltwater tank, and that block held an entire penguin, and water was coming out a bit oily, and somebody lifted the lid, and there was a
dead penguin.
A penguin floating around in the tank.
Well, I have
sure Holmes didn't get it out and cook it or something.
With a block going. With a black mark in the middle,
really?
A dog turd. And that, well, I don't know where you put it in, but it was certainly in the snow that we were cutting.
So hygiene was not a strength then?
Oh, no, definitely not.
Not really. And because there were so many dogs, we had lots and lots of pups. Mm. And from 3 months to 6 months, the pups were up around one. And then they were in and out, and up to all manner of mischief. And the place was just bedlam.
It was a place of dogs, you know. Stonington was a dog base.
Actually, I think to sum it up, Stonington Island Base was the last greatest working dog sledge base on the face of this earth. And they've been working.
How many men were there?
11.
So
11.
No, few 13.
More.
Yeah.
There was 16 in my last year.
Why does a handful of men need so many dogs?